This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello, I'm Cassie Huff. This is The Country Hour today across South Australia and the far west of New South Wales. Coming up, still a bit of rain around, dribs and drabs in places this morning, and that seems to have helped a lot of regions sow crops in the ideal window.
We've still got 400 hectares to go, but a lot of it would have been battling to come up without another rain, but now everything we've got should germinate quite well.
We're going to have a bit of a whip around the state to see how things are looking. And I'll head to Broken Hill for the 90-year celebration of the Royal Flying Doctor Service Base there. But first up today, this was big news this week, the APVMA approving the emergency mouse bait permit. The National Chemical Regulator, the APVMA, says it's worked tirelessly and in close partnership with industry bodies to quickly approve the emergency permit for the manufacture and use of double-strength mouse baits. Now, the permit was approved on Monday and comes as plague proportions of the rodent caused damage and distress in Western Australia in particular, but also here in South Australia's grain-growing regions as well. Scott Hansen is the Chief Executive of the APVMA, and he spoke to Belinda Varischetti, who asked him why it has taken so long to approve the stronger ZP50 mouse bait.
Well, the permit that we've approved was only submitted to us on Anzac Day. And in the absence of a application to consider something, we can't instigate or initiate our own registration of a product or use of a product. The permit that was submitted on Anzac Day, we have worked tirelessly over 3 weeks to consider all 11 of the unregistered products that we've approved for use. We have worked with the applicant, Grain Producers Australia, in partnership with GRDC and with CSIRO to turn what was initially a emergency permit for use in WA and South Australia into one now which is of use for all states and territories and therefore of greater value.
Well, farmers say the delay waiting for the APVMA has cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars and they're angry about that. Do you accept that you've cost the industry money in the time that it's taken to make this decision?
During the period that we've been making this decision, there's over 20 registered 25 gram per kilogram zinc phosphate baits available in the marketplace that are used and available. They're registered. They're available on a regular basis for people to get ahead and to try to head off mouse plagues. We acknowledge the fact that the numbers have built up to an extent in which an additional tool is needed. 3 weeks to turn around an emergency permit for 11 unregistered products of a Schedule 7 poison that is due to be applied broadacre across the environment. We've worked really quickly and in really close partnership with the industry bodies that have lodged the application to get this permit in the position it is. It's now available for people to use once they've undertaken the appropriate training, because as I said, this is a Schedule 7 poison. It is for broadacre use. We're wanting and having to ensure that we're balancing the long-term environmental impacts of the spread of the poison against the urgency of ensuring people are able to protect crops.
Do you expect to see some sort of compensation claim?
No.
Because there is talk of class action among some farmers here in Western Australia about the sort of costs that have been incurred as a result of the wait for this approval to come through.
It's been 3 weeks from when the application was made to when the permit's been issued. During that time, there's 20 registered products available for people to use of a product that is registered for use for
high levels of mouse populations in terms of the numbers they've been dealing with.
If it's totally ineffective, then there needs to be a question about why is it still able to be registered in the marketplace. And I think what we're looking at is the fact that the 25 milligram per kilogram dose rate is effective in treating mouse numbers. It's used on a year-in, year-out basis. The plague numbers that have built up have asked for additional double strength bait to be able to be used. An application was lodged on the 25th of April, was approved on the 18th of May. And in doing so, we've been able to ensure and put conditions on that permit that we believe will mitigate the risk of a widespread use of a Schedule 7 poison.
What were the main concerns that the APVMA was navigating in reaching an approval for this double strength bait?
I guess the key thing is the fact that zinc phosphide is a Schedule 7 poison. It's got high acute toxicity and it's a non-selective poison when it comes to, it's a vertebrate poison that's non-specific and will obviously have significant impact on any vertebrates that do consume the bait. We were looking to make sure that there were a set of, we were able to mitigate any risk the widespread use of this poison would have, because whilst we want it to obviously destroy the mouse populations, we don't want it having a significant non-target species impact at a population level. And so, when we're talking about non-targets, we're talking about cockatoos, rails, doves, pigeons, parrots.
That's mainly the bird life.
In terms of birds and also our native rodents.
And so what impact will these baits, now that they've been approved, what impact will they have on the environment, the wildlife, the birds?
If the conditions of the permit are followed, then we believe those impacts will be minimal and able to be they're able to be mitigated. We also require ongoing monitoring by those who are using this and notification of any impacts that they see so that we can collect that information to, again, put us in a better position to be able to consider any future applications that we get for zinc phosphide at a 50 level.
So there will be some birds or wildlife that die as a result of these baits being placed out?
Well, if there's wildlife that do consume the bait is toxic, it's non-specific. The set of circumstances and conditions that we've placed on the permit, such as the buffer zones around edge of crops, the dark colour of the baits, which differ from normal food like grains for the birds and therefore harder to spot on soils, the not applying on bare ground, so making sure that there's vegetation cover there. Again, all of these things work to reduce the potential impact, but we can't rule out having an impact. It's just making sure that it's not an impact at a population level for non-target species and that we're getting good reporting back from those who are wanting to use this in the field with regards to it being applied appropriately, the instructions followed, and not having non-target impacts.
The permit does expire mid-December. Will access to the product be automatic beyond that date if mouse numbers do reach above moderate numbers in any region across Australia?
No, the permit is through to the end of this calendar year and it will not automatically renew. If at that stage we still have mouse plagues, which would be really unusual, and we sought advice from CSIRO, from industry, with regards to the timing on this permit, as well as states and territories. If at the end of this year there are still ongoing mouse plagues that haven't been treated, then we'll need to ask questions about the efficacy of this current permit and consider what else might be needed if industry brings forward a further application.
Scott Hansen, the CEO of the APVMA, speaking with Belinda Varischetti. To the season now, and after years of drought, farmers in the Riverland and Mallee are sowing next season's crops into wetter soil and higher hopes. That's despite locust swarms and high input costs. Rain has brought optimism for families on the land. Eliza Berlage has this report.
As the auger fills with seeds, rain is filling farmers with optimism. Fifth-generation farmer Sam May says his property at Pater, just south of Loxton in the Murray Mallee, has had 230 millimetres of rain since January, more than double what they received last year.
Yeah, sowing into wet conditions is definitely a nice change. Yeah, so hopefully we'll get some nice germination and some even crops, and yeah, that's all we can really hope for.
Last growing season, after a couple of tough years of drought, he scaled back their farming operations and reduced fertiliser inputs.
Things over the last few years, there's been very hard to get crop establishment. So yeah, lots of bare patches in paddocks and lots of drift and lots of wind, which has been fairly well depressing. It definitely takes a toll on you mentally and physically trying to fix all these problems and know what to do at the end of the day. But yeah, so hopefully we're not out of the woods yet, but you know, hopefully we can have a decent season and just get some at least average rainfall from now till harvest, and it should turn out not too bad.
Mr. May says the wetter season is a relief.
So in this paddock here, we've got some barley. We had a fallow in here last year, so it was pretty bare and dusty. So hopefully we can get some barley established and get a nice bit of ground cover and get some soil cover with some stubble back. We've actually decided to not plant legumes this year just because we need to sort of regroup the farm and just get things covered again, and they just don't offer enough cover at the end of the day. Yeah, and a heavy cereal rotation this year, and we've got some tough weeds that we're trying to get rid of in gazanias, so they're a bit of a problem weed around here starting to pop up. So yeah, hopefully we can get on top of them and get some ground cover and stop some soil erosion.
About 60 kilometres north in Winara, near Paringa, green shoots are also appearing at the Rovers family farm. Fifth generation farmer Leah Rover is hoping to get a decent crop of vetch to feed her cattle after buying in what they could last year or reaching out for donated feed.
We've had a couple decent rains this year compared to last year, where we had, you might as well say nothing, nothing overly green last year, whereas this year there's a little bit around the green feed that we do have. It's there, but not overly beneficial at this point. For us, the feed is key at the moment, so we've mostly got livestock. But the other farmers that have put in crops, hopefully they get a germination out of it as well.
She says the drought has led to issues with sand drift. Locusts are also wreaking havoc.
I had a little bit of broadleaf come up, and then I did have some self-sown wheat come up, but as soon as it came up, the grasshoppers ate it all down. So I had 500 acres worth of feed there. I was about to put my stock on it, and then within a week, the grasshoppers ate it all. So we went back to scratch. My top farm, you would think I'm breeding them. They are everywhere. It might as well be snowing grasshoppers.
Senior agronomist at Elders Loxton, Brian Lynch, says more rain fell in his town from January to mid-May this year compared with all of 2025.
It allowed them to commit to most of their break crops and to sow the whole program. So last year, a lot of people stopped sowing halfway through, or they abandoned the more high-risk crops like canola and lentils and chickpeas. So we've had enough already before this weekend to actually commit to those and do the whole program. So people are happily going around 24 hours a day at the moment.
He says after a good start, farmers could afford to be a bit less risk adverse with seeding plans.
People still have to draw down on the equity to chase the crop. You can't do any more than get the rain. Once you've got the rain, then all options are open to you. But we probably could have planted a few more high risk crops like canola. We've shown that there is a return on investment there, but people probably haven't been in the mood to make that investment after the last 2 years.
Back amongst the cattle, Miss Rover is feeling committed to her farming future with energy after the rain.
So normally I would calve around now, but I've delayed it until August, September in hopes that I will be calving on green feed, because I've only ever calved on pretty much dirt, some sticks and some rocks, and I've had to hand feed. Whereas this year I'm hoping that we've got the green feed, my mums don't drop back in condition, I don't have to deal with orphans, and the weight gain is going to be hopefully a lot faster rather than having to put them in a feedlot situation and hand feed day in, day out. I've only ever wanted to be a farmer. I don't want to walk away from it, so you've got to do everything that you can to stay in the industry.
Fifth generation Riverland farmer Leah Rover ending that story from Eliza Burlage. And you can read more at abc.net.au/rural. But we're going to continue to have a whip around the state because, as I was saying, after years of drought, farmers around South Australia are sowing next season's crops into wetter soil and higher hopes. That's despite the locust swarms and the high input costs. And some properties on the Eyre Peninsula are hoping to reap the benefits from the storms that went through on Saturday afternoon. Farmers posting varying tallies on the Eyre Peninsula Facebook page at the ABC, with one farmer reporting 78 millimetres that fell at Yantanabe. Other recordings are 55 mil at Wongaree, and Peter Wake's family had flooding when 50 millimetres of rain fell in 20 minutes. Jodie Hamilton spoke to Robert Walsh, whose property at Mitchellville near Cowell had 70 mils of rain, and he says no one's complaining too much.
We were prepared for the rain. We're pretty sure by the way they forecast that something was going to happen, but we didn't expect the thunderstorms that come with it. So some of them were just sort of bucketed down. We had 70 mil out at Mitchellville, and luckily it's flat ground, so it didn't do too much damage at all. But yeah, I know Elbow Hill cut through there. A few guys have just finished seeding paddocks, and it washed them pretty bad. Yeah, one of our farms had 69 mil, but that's fairly flat. It washed a bit of it, but not nothing too terrible. The rain's going to do more good than harm. But yeah, the general readings around the district are from about 19 mil to 70, so it was all over the place with thunderstorms.
How big an area do you think it covered?
Oh, right up to Kimber, Buckle Boo Way there, 35, 40 mil right through. Cleves, same. I don't think anyone missed out. The only places I had missed out was down the southeast. They never got much. It was more a northern rain, but yeah, it was really good timing for us too, because it was starting to get a bit dry. We would have kept through, you know, gone through and finished. We still got 400 hectares to go, but a lot of it would have been battling to come up without another rain. But now everything we've got should germinate quite well.
Did you get rain earlier in the year, and were most people on to seeding early?
Yeah, we got about 50 mil February there. So, you know, the old 2 inches. And, yeah, that was fantastic. And then we had follow-up rain with that as well. So now I've got good soil profile. Things are looking good. The wheat price has lifted up a bit. We grow lentils as well, and they're still pretty steady. So, yeah, surprising how much canola's been growing this year too. Guys that, you know, we're not a big canola district, but guys are having a crack at that too. So the younger generation are pretty positive about farming around here. It's good.
Cowell is one of those areas where we have seen new sort of people coming into the farming industry as well. Would that be accurate?
I wouldn't say new families, but there's a lot of young men and women, you know, in that 30 to 40 age group, you know, right at their peak, best time to be doing it. And they're all good, willing to have a crack, not scared to borrow money, which the old generation never used to like to. And I think that's part of the reason they were held back. But the younger generation understand it better, finance and all that. Yeah, it's a different sort of generation. They certainly, I'm pretty proud of them, actually. A lot of my neighbours, yeah, they're doing well. They're good farmers too.
How does this season compare, say, to perhaps the last couple of seasons in your region?
This is the first time for the last nearly 4 years we haven't been sowing in dust. Blowing the air cleaners out every day, can't see where you're going. And you knew it wouldn't come up because it's that dry, but you just sow it together. Basically, you know, with the chemicals we got, we're pretty confident we're going to control the weeds. And it has worked by, you know, sowing early still, even when there's no moisture. The people that held off never seem to grow quite as good a crop. So, yeah, it's a really one of those really good starts. And as long as we get a bit of rain in September, we'll nearly get there. We put a fair bit in. We put about 6,000 hectares, 15,000 acres, and a bit over a third of that's lentils, and the rest is all wheat. No barley, no canola.
So how important is have the rains been for you?
Oh, absolutely. Best thing ever. Yeah. I've always been pretty positive, even in the drought years. We, you know, you take them as they come. But this year's, yeah, it's one of the best starts I've seen for a long time.
Mitchellville farmer Robert Walsh speaking to Jodie Hamilton. We've got a text in from Phil regarding the APVMA approval of ZP50, saying it would be good if the new mouse baiting program can avoid harming birds because some of them are natural control agents for the first mice getting established. I did actually put in a call to Birds SA as well on that exact topic, but they didn't have anything in particular to say. But yes, birds do play a vital role in some of the natural controls before they get too out of hand. So we'll keep across that as well. I know there's a reporting element to the permit, so hopefully that will be reflected in the reporting from the farmers who use the emergency permit. It's 24 minutes past 12. We're going to keep going with the whip around the state, looking at how the rainfall has affected them before we get into weather. Our reporter Karen Hunt has been talking to local farmers in the southeast of the state, starting with Richard Torch, who farms at Pujanagorik, 22 kilometres south of Bordertown.
So it started off probably 2.5 weeks ago. We had about 30 mils, which was fantastic. And then we had 8 mils over the weekend and probably a couple each night since then. So pretty happy at the moment.
And from the beginning of the year?
Yeah, we had probably a couple of inches back in February there. Was it, I don't know, end of February, something like that, I think. Summer rain, which brought up some summer weeds and a bit of feed. So, yeah, it's certainly a lot better than it was this time last year, that's for sure.
And I guess you're fairly well into your cropping program by now. How's that going?
Yeah, pretty good. We've got about 1,800 acres in and about that much again to go. So first of what we planted 3 weeks ago, which was barley down south, that's all come up and pretty good at this stage.
Is this the earliest that you have started on your cropping program?
Oh, no, other years, if there's been early rains, we've put barley for feed in the end of April and that sort of thing. It's about spot on where we'd want things to be. We normally try to have beans in by about the middle of May, and we're on beans yesterday, today and tomorrow. And so then we'll head on to canola, and all our hay ground has been in a fortnight ago. So, yeah, tomorrow canola and then wheat and barley after that. So hopefully another 2 to 3 weeks we'll wrap it all up.
Have you changed your cropping program at all in relation to what's been going on in the world?
No, we haven't, Karen. We've just got our usual quantity of, because we run a lot of livestock, we grow a fair bit of hay. So we just got our usual hay, beans, canola, wheat and barley rotation. We sort of haven't really changed anything much.
Richard Storch from Pujanagorik. A little further south at Western Flat, grazier Martin Harvey has had a cloudburst at one of his properties.
We've got three farms not very far from each other. Our home block has been a bit light on. We got about 6 mils on Saturday here at home, but 15 k's up the road on one of our other smaller blocks, we got absolutely smashed with 60 mils, which was quite incredible to see the difference in such a short distance.
Wow, what does 60 mils do to a property at this time of the year?
Well, we got surprisingly lucky. We've just clayed some new country and we put the spader over it, which did a remarkable job, I thought, when I got there Sunday morning. It was going to be an absolute mess, like, you know, runaways with coming off the hills and gutters and things, but it was amazing that most of the water has gone straight into the profile. We do have a couple of wet spots, which you'd have to expect with that sort of rain. I think it came in less than half an hour, so, you know, we don't often get torrential rain like that down here.
And that was just in that sort of one little area?
Yep. It was just a really small strip that came through and got a few people.
In general, how is your cropping program going?
We do a little bit of cropping. We grow a few lupins and a bit of barley. We haven't got our lupins in the ground yet, which I'd like to have had done, but we've been doing a lot of feed. We put a lot of barley and rye corn over our dryland lucerne paddocks. We're by far predominantly graziers, so we've put a lot of feed in. We started on about the 10th of April, and we've just done another round, finishing last week. Yeah, the difference with the growth, with getting it in April compared to May, is amazing. Ideally, we love to get as much done in April as we can, because you know, we can have lambing ewes on barley within 5 weeks, just with the warmer soil and everything. It's amazing how quick it can get up and going. But by far the earliest stuff, I think we could graze that probably in a couple of weeks.
Martin Harvey from Western Flat, ending that report from Karen Hunt. Like I said, we'll just get through this rain wrap before we get to weather. Some pastures in the southwest of New South Wales are enjoying the benefits of well-timed rainfall that has made for ideal sowing conditions there as well. Rachel Strun from Tolney Point Station, Pooncarie, has been sowing cereal crops over the last month and says it's some of the best conditions she's seen in 30 years. Rachel spoke to Lily McCure about how the season's shaping up.
So we're at the end of our cropping program, and we've enjoyed being sowing our cereals into a bit of moisture, which has been amazing.
We had some amazing rains sort of at the start of the year. How much did you get around that February, March time?
Yeah, we had over the our properties, we had 7.5 to 10 inches of rain that started on about the 20th of February, and it's just produced an amazing response to the soil for all our pastoral country, and now to be able to sow throw our cereals into a full soil moisture profile is a bit of a once in a lifetime. We've never seen it before, and we've been up here over 30 years, so it's been a fun sowing this year.
What's it looking like? What are those characteristics, and what makes it sort of so good to be excelling conditions?
We had our agronomist who did probes, and yeah, did probes down 2 metres, and there was full moisture the whole way, which yeah, normally we're dry sowing and hoping for rain to come in May and May, June, and you just always got your fingers crossed, whereas here we've got sowing into a full soil moisture profile, and we've had a few top-up rains as well. So on the weekend we had another 10 mil and everything's just wet up again and nearly everything's germinated that we've started sowing mid-April, and it's all a lot of it's all germinated and coming up, and just a real pleasure to drive around.
The rain on the weekend that you had, was that really great timing too?
Yeah, definitely. It was funny, we were just starting to bring up a bit of dust, which normally we're cleaning air cleaners and everything a couple of times a day because it's just, you're just working in dust all the time. And yeah, this is, I feel like we're in the Western District or somewhere because it's very unlike up here, but yeah, we'll take it while we can get it.
What crops are you putting in?
So we plant oats. We do hay with our oats, and then we have a cereal pulse rotation. So yeah, we do barley, wheat, and field peas. And yeah, we're just finishing off the last of the peas now, and sit back and watch it grow, hopefully. And yeah, we've sort of hung back trying to get it in a little bit later because we're a bit concerned about frosts at the other end of the season. So it was hard having all that rain and then having to wait until sort of April, May to try and get it into the ground because, yeah, we're notorious for frosts up here as well. Just come out of 2 years of really bad drought where we were feeding daily stock and that, and, yeah, to be sowing and just watching all our Dorper sheep are all lambing at the moment, so they got full udders and looking after all their lambs really well, and we haven't had to go near them to feed them because, yeah, we've got ample feed out in the paddocks for them. And, so sheep are happy, we're happy.
Pooncarey farmer Rachel Struan speaking with Lily McCure. And following that wrap of where the rain has fallen, we'll head to the Bureau of Meteorology to get a sense of what might be on the cards. Senior forecaster Simon Timke joins me. Good afternoon.
Hello, Cassie.
So we've been hearing about just how beneficial the weekend and into this week's rain has been to top up the rainfall over the last couple of months. What are you seeing on your charts?
Yeah, look, we certainly did receive some good rainfall in parts over the weekend, and pretty widespread too across the agricultural area. But sort of through the middle part of the week, it has eased back a bit. We've had a couple of weak fronts move across, but they've been well to the south. We've sort of seen a little bit more impact over Tassie and southern Victoria with those fronts. Generally not too much over the southern part of SA, but it has sort of been enough to sort of push some cooler southwesterly winds up over the agricultural areas. And we have seen a little bit of rainfall with that. In the 24 hours to 9 a.m. this morning, the rainfall was mostly the southern agricultural area, but we did see a couple of showers push a little bit further inland. Even Renmark managed to pick up a 0.6 of a millimetre and a millimetre at Loxton, but falls of 5 to 10 millimetres, about fairly widespread part of the Mount Lofty ranges, and elsewhere generally less than 5 millimetres. So a little bit around the place, and those showers largely clearing away too. Looking at the radar at the moment, we're still seeing a few showers up around the northern part of York Peninsula and southern part of the mid-north there. So still a little bit of light showery activity around the place. But I think through the afternoon we will see that ease back. And the totals since 9 a.m. have mostly been less than a millimetre or so. The next couple of days are going to be mostly dominated by high pressure ridge. So we won't be seeing too much in the way of showers at all for Thursday or Friday, really, particularly over the agricultural area. I think we might see a little bit of morning fog around the place on Thursday morning and Friday morning. Thursday should be mostly dry. Be surprised to see too much in the way of showers anywhere on Thursday, and similarly for Friday. Although on Friday we might start to see a little bit of showery activity starting to develop in the far west, but remaining dry over central and eastern parts of the state. those showers in the far west are ahead of a cold front that's approaching. So as that feature moves across on Saturday, we'll start to see those showers slowly extend eastward. So there'll be a chance of maybe seeing some showery activity move over central parts later on Saturday and continue over western parts. And then as we move into Sunday, see those showers move a little bit further eastwards. But certainly for the agricultural areas of the state, I think Thursday, Friday, Saturday likely to be dry and then a chance of something beyond that. For our rainfall totals for the 4 days to the end of Sunday, we're generally expecting less than 2 millimetres about central and eastern districts, 1 to 5 millimetres about southern coasts and ranges and in the west, and we might see some slightly higher falls about western coasts, maybe getting up to 5 to 15 millimetres. But generally for the agricultural area, less than 2 over the next few days.
Thanks so much for that, Simon.
Thanks, Cassie.
Simon Timke from the Bureau of Meteorology. In the far west of New South Wales, the upper western will be mostly sunny. Overnight, it's getting down to 6 to 9 degrees, but during the day, getting to 20. The lower western will be mostly sunny with patches of morning frost in the far east and a chance of some morning fog in the west there as well. Overnight temperatures falling to between 5 and 8 degrees with daytime temperatures reaching around the 19 degree mark. It's 24 minutes to 1.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Still to come in the program, did you know it's World Bee Day? After the news, we'll celebrate the humble bee, plays a small but vital role in keeping our crops pollinated and our food supply secure.
If we're looking at the European honeybee, it has a brain the size of a sesame seed, but it is able to navigate to and from its hive, maybe up to 10 kilometres away. And it is also making decisions on which flowers to visit, which flowers to avoid. And that's also what's leading to pollination and the reproduction of plants and food security.
More on that shortly. And a lovely text from Dan saying, very satisfying hearing the positive vibes from all areas, particularly the ones that have had it pretty hard for the last few years. Plenty of moisture, no dust coming up, and crops emerging beautifully in the southern Mallee too. Thanks, Dan. I definitely got the same sentiment from those chats we had with that bit of whip around the state. And we will put some of this up online and hopefully into a TV story as well, so we can share this good start to the season with people right across South Australia and indeed the rest of Australia. We will head to the news now, where Matt Coleman has the latest in news headlines.
Hello, Cassie. In the news this afternoon, the Health Minister says he's concerned about the detections of the bacterial infection diphtheria. 6 cases have been recorded in the state among the nearly 200 cases nationally. Blair Boyer says it's a concerning increase compared to the 7 cases which have been recorded in the last 35 years. The Prime Minister says right-wing politicians and their allies are deliberately trying to spook Australians over Labor's changes to the capital gains tax system. From July 2027, the CGT discount will be replaced by a new discount based on inflation, with real gains taxed at a minimum of 30%. This morning, 40 start-up business owners released an open letter criticising the move as an aspiration ambush. And Kangaroo Island's Landscape Board says little penguin numbers are rising. They had been dangerously low in recent years. It says the increase is from 228 to about 330 in Emu Bay on the island's north coast. Penashore on the island's northeast also recorded an increase. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Matt. Well, for 90 years, the Royal Flying Doctor Service at Broken Hill has ensured the community healthcare for those living in regional, rural and remote parts of New South Wales and South Australia as well. It's such an important institution there. And on Sunday, the organisation celebrated the anniversary of the first ever RFDS flight in 1928. That has coincided with the Broken Hill base's 90th birthday, separate events, but the 90th birthday for Broken Hill Base was celebrated, being celebrated today. And Lily McCure from the Broken Hill office went along. Hi, Lily.
Hey, Cassie.
So what was actually going on at the RFDS base in Broken Hill today?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, they are celebrating 90 years of the Royal Flying Doctor Service within New South Wales, but also the base in Broken Hill was the first Royal Flying Doctor Service base in New South Wales. And so a number of key guests and speakers have travelled out to attend the celebrations, lots of local volunteers and people from Broken Hill and the Far West gathered at the RFDS base in Broken Hill. So there was certainly lots of ambient sound as well, with planes taking on and off, and in the hangar as well, lots of memorabilia and historic information about the RFDS and some old retrieval planes. But yeah, lots of guest speakers and telling stories about how the RFDS was established and has evolved over the years, and as well just how they are able to help so many people in rural and remote areas, and they shared some personal stories of people that have a connection with the RFDS. So it's a great event going on out there.
Absolutely. It's a huge operation. Just how important is it to the community there?
It is a huge operation, and it's incredibly important, the celebration and the service and organisation itself. But I guess from what I saw this morning, just and people I've spoken to in the past or seen firsthand, but the RFDS is such a peace of mind for people in remote areas, whether that's on stations or in small rural communities that just don't have that immediate access to healthcare. So I guess they always know that the RFDS can be called and relied upon. And while I was out there this morning, I was speaking with Greg Sam, who is the RFDS Southeastern Section CEO, and I asked him how significant this celebration is for the RFDS.
This is an incredible milestone for us to have reached 90 years of the service, and to be able to recognise the critical role that Broken Hill played in both the establishment of a service in New South Wales, but its continued growth and development across the state through the last nine decades. So it's a great celebration and recognition of everyone who's really been part of the service, our staff, our volunteers and supporters, and those who have been very supportive of our service through the decades.
I mean, obviously, compared to now, it's changed a lot and evolved over the years. I mean, what were some of the key things that have changed and evolved in that time?
Look, our primary purpose and the reason that the service was established as part of John Flynn's vision across remote and central parts of the country was to be able to provide an emergency support, that mantle of safety that he referred to, that said when people living in rural and remote areas who were beyond access to healthcare needed help in an emergency, that that help would be there as quickly as it possibly could be through the use of our aircraft and our radio networks. So it was very much an emergency service in its origin. Since then, we've really continued to strengthen that part of our emergency services. And so our retrieval service is very much as it was 90 years ago, albeit the aircraft are different and the level of care we're able to provide is quite significantly higher. However, we've now grown the number of services and the types of services we're providing across the state and particularly across far western New South Wales.
Particularly in the far west, as you say, there's great outreach sort of programs and outback clinics that are really important to communities. How long have they been sort of going and how important were they to sort of establish back in the days?
So our primary care has really been evolving through the last 40, 50 years, which started out being able to do remote fly-around clinics. So this was an opportunity to use our aircraft and our staff when we weren't being called into an emergency to provide other forms of care locally, in community, in stations, etc. And since then, we've been able to grow the types of primary care we can provide from general practice through to allied health, mental health in particular, drug and alcohol services, and health promotion services. And we do that now in a way that is reflective, I guess, of the way that that care is delivered across the country, whether that be in clinics, in community, whether that is still part of our drive around or fly around clinics, or whether we do now a lot more telehealth because the technology allows us to do that. But there is this increasing need within community for that type of support. because, as we're seeing, that the demographic changes, particularly in small rural communities, is seeing a decline in the access to what was originally taken for granted to have a local GP or a local community health centre. We're seeing a number of communities losing those types of services, and that we see ourselves as being able to contribute to come in and provide those services where we're able.
As you say, there's a real increased need, particularly out in these communities, for connection and, you know, the RFDS's services. Is the RFDS, I guess, able to sort of keep up with this demand, and is there more support that's sort of needed to be able to reach these areas?
Look, the demand is growing beyond, I guess, our capacity and our resourcing currently. When you look at our service profile, we continue to grow, you know, at 10% or more each year. We're now just across New South Wales and our border regions able to provide close to 100,000 occasions of service a year. Now, that still only really meets a fairly defined priority need. If you look at the total need, there's still a lot more we could do. There is limitation and challenge in us being able to continue to grow our funding and resource base. That's something we're working with governments. It's something we have a very close relationship with our donors to make sure that their support aligns to what they see the priorities are for us to support. And that's been part of that growth, that a lot of our, you know, fundraising and donor funds are directed towards the creation and establishment of these new services.
And we're obviously here in Broken Hill, which was the first base that was established in New South Wales. I mean, what's that looked like for Broken Hill, and how has that this base here really evolved?
Look, it's been very much at the centre of the community, as with many other institutions in and around Broken Hill. So the current site of the current base out at the airport is the second base. The first base that was established really was in operation up until the 1980s, and then it was moved out here to be closer, I guess, to the general aviation and aviation infrastructure. But what you find now around our base out here is it's not only a working aviation base and aeromedical base, we also host our Clive Bishop Medical Centre, and a lot of our primary healthcare services are staged and based from here as well. So it looks and feels as much like a health service as it does a working operational aviation base.
So, yeah, we're celebrating 90 years. What do you reckon the next 90 years might look like for the RFDS?
Look, everyone asks me that question, and I really ask them back. I think we will respond to what's needed. That's what we've done. That's what's made us successful. I think that the absolute priority is always that concept of the mantle of safety, that as an emergency assurance for communities and individuals who live and work and travel through the remote parts of our state, knowing that this service is available does make a significant difference to how people feel about either remaining in community or participating and travelling through community. So I think that will continue. I think the growth in the range of services we provide and how we deliver them will change with the advent of emerging technologies, I'm sure, but also community expectation. So we think that the future will be both technology-led, but also an opportunity to, I guess, have a closer relationship with people around what is their healthcare needs. And I think finally that RFDS, whilst it will have its own unique place, will also be part of the broader pattern of the way that healthcare services and healthcare delivery is provided into community.
Greg Sam, who is the Royal Flying Doctor Service Southeastern Section CEO, speaking with Lily McCure, who was at Broken Hills RFDS this morning. It is coming up to 11 minutes to 1, and did you know today is World Bee Day? Happy World Bee Day. Bees obviously play a critical role in our food systems, But for years, populations around the world have been declining, especially native bee populations. And now we have the varroa mite here in Australia as well. We'll see the effects of that. Monash University's Dr. Scarlett Howard studies bee pollination and bee intelligence. She says she's learning some fascinating facts about bee behaviour, and there's still plenty more research to be done.
It's actually quite hard to know in Australia at the moment because there's not a lot of information on how things like climate change and urbanisation are impacting our estimated 2,000 to 3,000 species of native bees. But we do know from a lot of other regions and globally that bees are generally in decline at the moment, and major drivers do include things like increased temperatures, habitat fragmentation, sometimes caused by urbanisation, agricultural intensification, and pesticides and a lot of other things like that as well.
Why do we have that information in other regions in the world, but we don't have that data for Australia?
Particularly in different parts of Europe and North America, they do have long-term data sets of populations of insects and bees. However, in Australia, we don't have that really long-term data. So even if we start now, it'll take us a little while to work out, are they in decline? Are they increasing in their populations? Or are they sort of staying stable and we don't need to worry too much? I would expect that since it's a global trend, we'd be looking at a decline in our native bee species in Australia.
Have we seen any impact on European honeybee populations in Australia and those hives that are used to pollinate some of the horticultural industries?
Talking about European honeybee population decline and hive decline can be tricky because sometimes you'll hear that it's absolutely fine. Other times you'll hear, no, there's declines, we're having losses. Generally in Australia, our honeybees have historically been very, very healthy. But with the new varroa mite actually that has come in the last few years into Australia, I expect that we might start to have some issues. And already, obviously, there are quite a few beekeepers who have been impacted by it.
You also have been doing some fascinating work around bee intelligence and their pollination capacity. The honeybees that you study are called volunteers. Are they actually choosing to work with you?
They absolutely are choosing to work with us. So we have the European honeybees. They're the bees that live in those hives of sometimes, you know, 80,000 individuals living together. And what we do is offer them sugar water in exchange for participating in our experiments. So we'll put sugar water out. We'll let the hive know it's there by bringing a couple of bees over on a spoon with sugar water on it and showing them that we've got these sugar feeders. And then we offer them even better sugar, so a higher concentration of sugar to water, to come over and look at images that we show them, or, you know, go through mazes or things like that. And the bees will continue to come back and forth between the questions we want to ask them and the little pictures we're showing them and their hive. And they'll do that all day. So we call it a little bit of voluntary participation because they could just disappear at any time. They could go back to their hive and decide not to come back to us, or go off and forage on some flowers and we wouldn't be able to stop them. So they really do like opt in to do the experiments to get sugar water from us.
With a little bit of help from a little bit of bribery there maybe. What about native bees? Are they as cooperative? What have you learned about them?
We are at the beginning of learning about our native bee cognition. So I'm really excited to actually be at the forefront of this. We haven't worked out a way to have them opt into experiments. So instead, what we do with them is we do catch and release or observation. So we go out and we look at the bees on the flowers. We see what they're landing on, what they like. And then sometimes we might take a few from the environment. We'll ask them some questions as well in exchange for sugar water, and then we'll re-release them back into their environment pretty quickly after we take them, just so they're having minimal stress.
What have you learned about bees' intelligence? What is it that they can do that was perhaps a bit of a surprise to you?
With the European honeybees, they are always surprising us as to how much intelligence they're showing. So we've looked a lot at their numerical abilities and found that they can do things like addition and subtraction, categorizing quantities of items as odd or even. They can also show an understanding of the concept of zero and basically a lot of things like that. That's what we've done. There's also a lot of other great research out there that shows that they can recognize human faces. They can differentiate between different artists' paintings. So if you showed them like Monet versus Picasso, they're highly intelligent and they're really, really good at learning.
Absolutely fascinating. What's the link between what you've learned about how brainy bees are and their role as pollinators. Can you use that information within pollination programs, or does it have uses in other applications in life?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both, actually. So one reason we're very interested in the intelligence of bees is to look at how that intelligence might change, you know, if they're undergoing stress from environmental stresses, like, again, we're talking about climate change, urbanisation, pesticide use, and that sort of thing. But we're also looking to understand how they learn things, and particularly how they learn complex things, because you can imagine these bees, if we're looking at the European honeybee, it has a brain the size of a sesame seed, but it is able to navigate to and from its hive, maybe up to 10 kilometres away. And it is also making decisions on which flowers to visit, which flowers to avoid. And that's also what's leading to pollination and the reproduction of plants and food security and that sort of thing.
So it is World Bee Day. Dr. Scarlett Howard, what is your favourite bee fact, the one thing that you just think is so interesting about bees?
One of the most interesting facts is the diversity of bees that exist in Australia and globally. So in Australia, we have an estimated 2,000 to 3,000 native bee species, and I think a lot of people don't actually know that. And globally, a recent study has just come out that estimates our global bee diversity at maybe 24,000 to 26,000 bee species. So there's a lot of bees out there, and they're all different shapes, sizes, and colours. We've got blue bees, we've got, you know, bright yellow bees, we've got little tiny black ones with cream stripes, we've got ones that have these face masks that are coloured yellow. There's just such a huge diversity of bees across the globe, and particularly in Australia. And I think that's my favourite fact for this year on World Bee Day.
That's Dr. Scarlett Howard, a bee scientist from Monash University, speaking with Fiona Broom. And I just had a bit of a laugh. Peter from Boolaroo wrote in saying, oh, it's Bee Day. I thought you were going to talk about the bathroom accessory, the bidet. I do speak quickly, so maybe that's what it sounded like. Thanks for that text, Peter. To the cattle markets now, and Selena Green has the Dublin market report for you today. Hi, Selena.
Good afternoon, Cassie. A fair to average quality yarding of 4,000 lambs and 650 sheep came forward at Dublin this week. The usual trade and processor buyers were active, along with specialty butchers, feeders and restockers, with the overall quality returning to an easier price trend. Heavy crossbred lambs and merinos were most affected, as a small yarding of mutton sold firm to Deira on the previous sale. Light crossbred stores sold from $180 to $220, as the better type sold from $230 to $240 a head. Trade weights range from $245 to $260. Heavy trades sold from $260 to $275, with a few extreme heavyweights selling from $300 to $367 a head. Light merino stores sold from $130 to $150, as the better type sold from $190 to $220 a head. Trade weights range from $220 to $230. Heavy trades sold from $240 to $255, with a small number of extreme heavyweights selling from $285 to $310 a head. Light mutton sold from $120 to $150. Trade weights range from $180 to $210, with heavyweights fetching from $230 to $280 a head. And there's no cattle report today. This report has been prepared by John Traeger on behalf of MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks, Selena. And in the southeast, Peter Kerr has the results from the Mount Gambier market.
Good afternoon, Cassie. This is the Mount Gambier cattle report for the 20th of May. Numbers lifted a little here. Agents shouted 488 head of live weight and open auction cattle this week. There was a larger field of buyers, with the trade feeders and restockers all active over the pens. Quality was very mixed, with something for all of the orders in a market that sold at mostly dearer rates. A small number of veelers came forward to return for mostly 485 to 510 cents a kilogram. Yearling steers were small in number. Feeder sort steers from 448 to 500 cents. Some restocker activity here to 470. Yearling heifers sold to the trade from 380 to 466 cents, lift 8 cents with feeder support to once again 470 cents a kilogram. Brown steers and bullets lifted up to 20 cents. They sold from 473 to 485 cents to the trade, and to feeders from 475 to 495. Brown heifers saw trade support from 436 to 480 as feeders operated from 318 up to 458 cents a kilogram. A run of lightweight manufacturing steers came forward to sell from 372 to 424. Competition from both feeders and restocker orders for those. Heavy cows made up the bulk of the market. They received a lift of 10 cents to sell from 370 to 402. Lighter lots from 322 to 374, with a small number attracting the restockers at 312 cents a kilogram. It was a small offering of bulls as they sold from mostly 398 to 420, an isolated sale here at 466 cents a kilogram. This has been Peter Kerr for the MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thanks for that, Peter. And that's all we have time for in the Country Hour today. As Dan said in his text, it is very satisfying to hear the positive vibes across South Australia. We hope it continues through the season to get timely, appropriate, gentle rain. But we'll keep our fingers crossed for that. If you'd like to find out more, go online to abc.net.au/rural, including a look at South Australia's seeding setup. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.